American colonies, with Brazier admitting it had been a badly fought war, Flaherty claiming it was one that should not have been fought at all. "And I would wish Ireland to be 3,000 miles away by water, then we too might be free." Sensing a bit of Irish belligerence, Brazier picked up a bottle and refilled Flaherty's glass for the umpteenth time. "Now that is a subject that does not sit well with such fine wine." Sat facing the door. Brazier saw Daisy Trotter not so much fill the doorway as slide into it, half-hugging the frame. By his dress and appearance, he knew the card room was not for the likes of him. Those in occupation, either playing or merely drinking and conversing, were people of substance. Successful men of trade, or merchant ship captains come ashore to take their ease. Half tempted to go to meet him, Brazier decided to hold his place. Trotter had requested this meeting, and there was no intention to ask Saoirse for her parlour once more. Also, his mood was rather salty. Not angry, but disinclined to consideration. It took a while before Daisy realized he was not going to be indulged, while it was a measure of his perceived station that he moved like a man more at home in the shadows than strong candlelight.
"Shall I leave you to it, Edward?" Flaherty asked, just before Daisy reached their table.
"Why allow yourself to be troubled? I can't see there will be much to concern me."
Daisy's progress had attracted a certain degree of attention, even from the card players, and none of it was benign. Brazier compounded what he later saw as deliberate and pointless rudeness by issuing no invitation to sit. It was Flaherty who moved to give the man space to slide into a chair.
"What is it I can do for you, Trotter?"
The answer was some time in coming. Daisy was looking around the room, examining faces, his own showing apprehension, which got an exasperated response.
"You've nothing to be concerned about here, man."
"That's so," was the sniffed response. "Happen I know who might be a threat when you lack a clue, being a stranger. Just because folk who are coated in silk don't make 'em honest, and I could name one who fits that notion well."
"Your business?"
"In heaven's name, Edward, offer the man a drink."
"Do you take wine, Trotter?"
"Not by habit."
Flaherty was on his feet to offer Trotter a drink as Brazier pointedly emptied his goblet and refilled it. "I'll have some porter sent over if that serves."
That acceded to, and the Irishman moving away, Brazier gave the now seated Trotter a look that demanded he speak. "There's a cargo of contraband coming in this night."
"From what I've been told, barely a night goes by when that's not the case."
"Tulkington's contraband."
Without knowing it, Daisy had moved to become equated with William Pitt, and the mood Brazier was in, not good in any case, went down like a falling barometer registering a coming tempest. Another goblet of wine disappeared. "How many times do I have to tell people hereabouts I have no interest in smuggling, both your kind?"
Brazier stopped himself from naming Pitt, but added,
"And the revenue can go to the devil."
Flaherty returned to place a pot of porter in front of Trotter. Then, looking at Brazier's stony expression, he picked up his goblet and departed again, murmuring an excuse so softly delivered it was missed.
"There we are, a convivial evening with a friend ruined."
"Orker and his lot have gone to see it safe in."
"And what do you expect of me?"
Daisy was surprised at the question, clearly seeing the matter as obvious. "If they's doing that, there can't be too many left behind at the slaughterhouse. Happen there be a chance to get free, whoever it is they's holding there."
"You don't seriously expect me to help you rescue them?"
"Be to your advantage to have help, Captain Brazier, would it not?"
"Help to do what?"
The question was so obtuse. Daisy was thrown. From what he'd heard about this naval cove, it had to be said mainly from the crossing sweeper who worked by St. George's Passage. He was a kindly soul, considerate and never failing to smile and tip a coin. The man opposite, now, was nothing like that. If Daisy had never served in the Navy, he had been aboard ship with hard and mean sods as owners or masters. That was what he was seeing now.
"You're suggesting I stir myself,"
Brazier growled.
"And the men you have, too,"
Daisy replied, a plea in his tone.
"To get out of Hawker's slaughterhouse. A lot who've already been given a drubbing by him and his men. And what happens then, Trotter? Who will Hawker come after?"
"He can be taken on if we's combined."
"I think you mistake my purpose."
"You want to go up against Tulkington? You put a pistol to his head, did you not?"
"Even if I did, I cannot see how the notion of becoming involved in a confrontation between two smuggling gangs will serve my needs."
If Trotter had hinted at a plea previously, there was no mistaking it now. His voice broke as he insisted,
"I gotta get my Dan out from Hawker's clutches."
"Then I suggest you find another way, because I am not it."
"I'm on my own,"
came out as a loud, head-turning cry. The looks aimed at the corner they were occupying went from the mildly curious, through slightly alarmed, to the seriously put out, when it came to the men at the card tables. It was not loud enough to bring Serge into the card room at precisely that moment. That had to be mere coincidence, but it did bring her to Brazier's table.
"Is everything as it should be?"
The reply came as the brazier goblet was filled again.
"In my case, yes. Do I have to introduce you to Daisy Trotter?"
"I know the name and the face, but have never made acquaintance."
"Perhaps something to be thankful for."
That got a pained look from Daisy, which Brazier ignored by taking a gulp of wine, on which the look changed to one of alarm as he added,
"He would scarce believe what it is he's asking me to do. He wants me to go to Hawker's slaughterhouse and prize from that sod's grasp a bunch of useless creatures I wouldn't give a hammock to on any ship of which I had command."
"They're good lads,"
was the protest.
"I'd be asking you to keep your voice down," Serge hissed. "This room is quiet for a reason."
"So you won't aid me?"
"I don't think that requires an answer."
It was now Daisy conjuring up the name of William Pitt, as well as the rumours going around that this bastard was in league with him. If he'd heard the gossip, it had been mixed with what folk saw as a remedy. With knowledge of that, Brazier might change his tune. As he explained, it did not look like it from the disbelieving expression.
"Me conspiring with Pitt," he cried.
Now he got a look from Serge that had him moderate the level of his own voice to an angry hiss.
"Whoever sold you that canard has too vivid an imagination."
"You've visited him and dined with him at the Three Kings twice, or so I've been told."
"God in heaven, this town!"
That came with a look of irritation aimed at Serge. Not of condemnation, but a general disapproval of deal. If he'd expected any response from her, it was denied. She had on her face a look that said, "I told you so." There was a temptation, nothing to do with Daisy, more to do with her, and enhanced by his drinking, to tell of Pitt's proposal and his refusal. He would also be open about the reason the idea had been floated in the first place, as well as the pressure to which Pitt hoped he would succumb. That was until he realized, having consumed way too much wine, the danger of allowing his tongue to run away with itself.
"Well, you may go, Trotter, and tell the idiots spreading the rumor they are wrong."
"And the other?"
"I'm not minded to repeat myself."
He didn't move immediately. It was as if Daisy, looking into the tankard of a yet-to-be-touched porter, was racking his brain for a way to change Brazier's mind. Words that would get him what he so desperately needed. The man opposite gave no indication such arguments existed, so Daisy eased himself out of his chair and wiped his nose with his sleeve before nodding to Serge. Brazier was not prepared to let him go without a parting shot.
"I suspected the last time we met you were seeking to use me for your own ends, Trotter. Be aware I'm not fool enough to fall for it. That obviously stung. Daisy going from miserable reflection to anger in a flash. Calling over his sloping shoulder as he left,
"You might be more fool than you know, matey."
The deep-laden vessel, drifting a mile off the shore, could see the lights of Dover, the beacons that marked the harbour entrance and the glim of multiple pinpoints behind, which denoted occupied buildings. A look around the invisible horizon showed any number of other pinpoints which marked the positions of vessels either hove to for safety, or for the more adventurous, those making their way through the channel narrows, despite it being a cloudy night. Right ahead, over the prow, beyond its own lanterns, was Stygian blackness. A lantern, seemingly suspended in mid-air, flashed three times, the signal for which the French captain had been waiting. John Hawker, standing behind it, saw the return message, a lamp shaded and unshaded to tell him his message had been received. On the other arm of St. Margaret's Bay, a second light appeared, by which time the sails on board the ship, which had been backed and were flapping loosely, were drawn tight to take what little wind there was, which set the timbers creaking as the vessel began to move. On the wheel, the Frenchman kept those two lights in his sights as he bisected them with his bowsprit. Another lookout, placed aloft, was concentrating on the unseen higher ground. If anything shone from there, it would mean danger, which would see the cargo ship put up its helm and withdraw. On either beam, crew members with the sharpest eyes made sure nothing was approaching from north or south. They were safe until the ship was close to making its landfall. In the cabin was a proper manifest of the cargo with details of the goods carried and for whom they were destined. All were proper names of legitimate importers, so they could plead innocence, being off course if intercepted. Having made the crossing several times, the fellow in command knew, by his position relative to those shore lanterns, when to give the order to drop a stern anchor. This paid out on a stout cable as the ship inched in. The rest of his crew had been travelling between holds and deck, first unlashing the cargo, chests and bales secured against the motion of the sea, then fetching part of what was uncovered onto the deck, this to save time. There was a solitary figure in the chains, casting a weighted line and seeking to calculate the depth of water under the keel. At a soft call from him, the movement of cargo was abandoned. The sweeps, laid along the deck, were slipped into the water through portholes. The sails, under which they'd been edging, let loose again. Now they were inside the arc of the bay, the prow was set at the well-lit mouth of the main tunnel. Figures could be seen descending ladders to make their way down to the water's edge, one party waiting for a line which would be thrown from the ship's stern once the prow had been very gently beached. This, and another from the bows, would be lashed off to the dolphins, to hold the craft in position. From a virtually silent manoeuvre, the noise grew markedly. Even whispers and low calls multiplied if issued by dozens of throats. The extra-wide gangway was opened, the gangplank shoved out to be taken by willing hands who moved at the landward end as far as possible to create a shallow slope. That done, unloading could begin, the holds needing to be stripped in very short order. A line of bearers took the barrels, bolts and small bales, as well as wooden chests of tea, scrabbling over the shingle, and then up the wide ladders into the tunnel. John Hawker had a very limited view of what was happening, but then he had no need to see something that happened a dozen times a year, only broken off when the midsummer months denied them the darkness in which to work. Inside the tunnels, in single file, the bearers of the contraband trudged their way up the slight incline and into the tunnel, which led to the chambers hewn out of the stable chalk, where the cargo would be stored prior to distribution. Hawker appeared halfway through the unloading to make his way in the reverse direction and to clamber down to the beach. He found the Frenchman at the base of the gangplank, and a few words in his language, just about all Hawker knew, were exchanged. Then it was mainly silence, if you excluded the sounds of heavy breathing, displaced shingle, and the odd curse when someone slipped. Eventually the time came for Hawker to go aboard and check the holds were clear, to take from the Frenchman the manifest, accurate in all respects, excluding the intended recipients. He passed over to the captain his fee, a leather pouch heavy with coin, before making his way back to the beach, watching while those of the crew on land went back aboard, the gangplank being drawn in. At a soft call, the securing cables were loosened and hauled inboard, while men on the capstan dug their feet into the deck and leant on the poles, to pull the stern out into deeper water. As many as were available of Hawker's porters put their shoulders to the hull and pushed. Slowly the vessel refloated to be hauled out to a point where sails could be reset, the yards having been hauled round to take enough wind to get away on a ship that would set course for its home port. The ladders were withdrawn back into the tunnels, the entrances shuttered off, leaving the strand clear of humanity. At first light, a couple of Hawker's men would come to the beach to ensure no trace of the night's activities existed, items dropped or a coat discarded. Meanwhile, the man who employed them ensured that all was properly stacked. His porters paid their copper and dispersed. Out at sea, the three times shading of a lantern told those on the clifftops it was time to depart. Last to leave was John Hawker, who made his way back to the hut, to where he'd left his horse munching on a hay net in the nearby bothy, sitting down to wait for daylight. When that arrived, he had to lead the animal up the steep path to the grassy leas which ran to the cliff edge. There he could mount and ride home, free from any danger of inadvertently going over a cliff edge in darkness. Henry Tulkington would come the other way, possibly tomorrow or the day after, with the manifest Hawker had in his pocket to check it against the cargo and make sure nothing was missing that should not be. That established, he could alert the other half of the coastal enterprise, run by a man John Hawker had never met, to begin distribution of the contraband to his waiting customers. Chapter 20. The pressure of time obliged Henry Tulkington to hire a private coach to get him back home. He arrived in the early hours of the morning in a reasonably good mood, which for him meant no one got a frown for some perceived error, which lasted until he was presented with Durley's letter. The mere fact of it having been written was enough to make him angry. That his aunt had read it doubled the feeling, which was awkward since the emotion had to be concealed. It did not sit well with him, but he knew he needed Sarah Lovell too much to offend her for something that could not be undone. Nor did he have time. He needed to go and see John Hawker to check if the cargo had come in as arranged, that it conformed to what was expected. So any thoughts on what his uncle might be up to would have to wait. Once more, it required the use of a horse, St. Margaret's Bay being another place he could not risk being seen by the prying eyes of curious servants. Coming out of the front door, he saw a stable boy holding his animal by the mounting block, but his attention was taken by Creevy, signalling to him, clearly a plea for attention. Given the man was standing over some ornately trimmed yew topiary, Henry assumed it was that he wished to talk about, so he decided to give the gardener a minute or two. He did, after all, care for the first impression given to a visitor approaching the house, and the formal parterre was an important part of that. "What can I do for you, Creevy?" he asked, once the man's hat had been removed.
"There's summat I reckon you might like to know, Your Honour."
The look of mystification had Creevy blurt out what it was.
"Upton has taken a walk in some of his horses down by the lake of a morning, regular-like, if different animals."
"I cannot see that makes—" Henry stopped, looking right into the old man's watery eyes, slightly thrown by the look the gardener sent to right and left, as if, absurdly, he did not want to be seen talking to his employer. It was that look which nailed it, but he was not going to ask if Upton met anyone on those walks. Creevy was not to be alerted to family affairs, but it was obvious what he was driving at. "I'm obliged to you,"
was delivered with a look that told him he was to say no more.
"I'll just look out for you, Mr. Henry. You being the kind gent you are."
It would have shocked no one who knew him that Henry Tulkington took that at face value. He saw himself as a benevolent master. "Garden is looking splendid, a testament to your care." With Creevy's hat already in his hand, an obsequious touch of the forelock was required, even if it was delivered to his master's retreating back. Henry could read into what he'd been told everything that was implied. No one ever walked the horses in the woods around the lake, even if it was not expressly forbidden. Ergo, if he was doing so, it must be for a reason. Another problem to be dealt with, but finding what it entailed would have to wait. He mounted, and as soon as he was in the saddle, he kicked his mount into motion.
"Smooth it were," was Hawker's report, "which is a relief after what Spafford and his lot got up to last time."
What had been a smiling face clouded. Hawker was still smarting from having part of the previous cargo pinched from under his very nose, on the same strand of pebbles he'd visited the night before. It had sent him into the passion that had ended in him collaring Spafford Jr., hauled out of a gin shop, and very publicly dragged along the main road of the town to the slaughterhouse.
"Speaking of which, couldn't risk any trouble with a cargo coming in, so I sat on matters regarding Brazier, but I can tell you it's festering. And for my money, the longer that goes on, the better."
"Holding them all here has a risk, John. It can't be kept a secret forever."
"With respect, I don't reckon anyone to take me on, and another day won't hurt. I'll get out and about once I know all's well at the bay. A little bit of coin spent on porter and gin for the right folk, and they'll be champing to string the bugger up."
"Which must be prevented." Seeing a look bordering on disappointment, Tulkington was quick to add an admonishment. "He might be a sod, and one I would welcome gone permanently, but he is still a post-captain in the King's Navy. A man like that is too elevated to be strung up by a baying mob, without which we will suffer serious repercussions. Understand that those responsible for order hereabouts will stand for much and look the other way, but not that." The expression on Tulkington's face left no doubt about his sentiments, nor were they a mystery. For all his power locally, it rested on certain norms that must not be breached. It was axiomatic that those who turned a blind eye must not be given cause to look in order to protect their own position. "Out of deal will serve, though a few heavy bruises won't go amiss."
"Those I will see to personally,"
came with a growl, which was a mistake. The rebuke was swift, with no concession to his pride, already a touch dented.
"I've told you, John, stay out of it."
It hurt to reply in a voice which to him sounded weak and submissive. "Course, Mr. Tulkington, I was meaning I will see the right folk know what to do, and what not to do, which is to go too far. Now, the manifest." The document was handed over to be perused, but he did not produce from his pocket the matching list, one of two documents which had been couriered down weeks past by Durley. The two would not match exactly, given that goods coming from various regions of France could not be guaranteed to arrive in a given time. That country was cursed with any number of internal borders, with each region seeking to levy a transit tax on anything going to a neighbour and beyond. Quite apart from legal delays, a lot of inter-province smuggling went on, which also had an impact. There was no cause for concern if some things were late, as long as they came over the channel eventually, so the books in Durley's safe balanced over something like a 12-month.
"You don't want to see Spafford, then?"
"I will spare myself that.
He keeps asking about his boy,
who is safe from everything but his own bad habits." Catching the look of inquiry, Tulkington went on. "Tell him nothing. The less he knows, the better."
"Me too, by the sound of it,"
Hawker assumed. Sarah Lovell had not been fooled by Henry's unruffled response. She'd known him too long, and too well, and had been prepared for a blast of invectiveness. When it didn't come, it naturally set her to thinking. It could not be anything to do with her feelings. Her nephew was indifferent to those, and not only hers. A woman who rarely sat down for long, she went to the drawing room and took up a chair in front of the unnecessary fire, one lit to keep the master happy, looking into it as if seeking a solution. Something had changed in their relationship, just as it had between her and Elizabeth, though in that case it had done so for the worse. It was slow to surface, but come it did, and the notion of an alteration vis-à-vis Henry warmed her more than the blazing logs. But what animated it? Was it need or fear? The need to control and watch Elizabeth, or a dread that she might turn against him and act as a witness for her niece, one so potent the marriage could be annulled? As well as warmth, there was a delicious feeling of power, one she'd not felt since lording it within Canterbury society.
"To be enjoyed as long as it lasts."
"Sorry, Mrs. Lovell." Spinning round, she saw an underfootman with a scuttle of logs. Thinking the room empty, he'd entered without knocking, which got him an immediate rebuke, more harsh than necessary due to her being surprised as well. The decision she made then was one to make her blood course, an exercise of what she saw as her new power, though few would have rated it worth the description.
"No more wood in here. It makes too much mess. Coal from now on."
That acknowledged, she went up to knock on Elizabeth's door. As soon as it opened, she said with a sweet smile, seen by the recipient as deeply insincere,
"You say you wish to visit the Colpoys again?"
"I do."
"Then send a note over this morning, asking if you can call this afternoon."
"Henry has given permission."
"No, Elizabeth."
Was delivered firmly.
"I have decided it should be allowed. I take it you will be going out for your usual walk."
"I will."
"I would find it obliging if you would find me and tell me first."
Daisy Trotter was sat on the long pebble strand of Sandwich Flats, looking at the twin luggers owned by Dan Spafford, pulled high up the beach and well out of the water, so even the highest tide would not trouble them. He was wondering what to do, if anything, about them. Would a sum of money get Dan free? And would selling the boats meet the purpose? Would that be approved, given they were his sole way of making a crust? Daisy'd never realized before how much he depended on Dan. It came as a jolt to realize how the way he had seen their relationship was the complete opposite of the truth. His old friend flattered him by letting him think for old time's sake. His advice was not only important, it was welcomed, heeded and needed. In truth, Dan disposed, and he obeyed. Perhaps a decent payment for the saving of, if not his life, then... The large and hairy bugger had had an eye for handsome young Dan and would not leave him be. It had taken time before the matter could be sorted, with both unsuspecting what was coming. The sodomite had cornered Dan on deck during a dark and cloudy night, with a bit of sea running off the Skagerrak. Hidden by the man's bulk and pleading to be spared what was being suggested, Dan had not even known his assailant had been knifed. He might have guessed by the time the third strike went in. Daisy's victim had turned to deal with him, screaming blue murder, quick as a flash on spotting Daisy and the slight gleam of his blade. Dan had whipped a marlinspike out of the rack by the falls and thumped the sod over the crown with all his young lad's strength. Stunned, Daisy got his blade into the ribcage, seeking the heart. Dan never knew if he found it, only that the bugger crumpled to the deck. How they found the strength to lift his dead weight and tip him over the side was as much a mystery. The blood was there for all to see come morning, while all knew one of their number was missing and what he was like. If they had an inkling of who had done the dirty, no one let on. It was logged as a mystery and one soon forgotten once the deck had been sanded and swabbed. They'd been like two peas in a pod ever since, and if Dan knew what Daisy secretly longed for and never dared say out loud, he kept his own counsel. Now was just like being on that dark and rolling deck again. The man he loved was in danger, and it was down to him to sort it.
Betsy was still wondering as she walked about that exchange with her aunt.
No one could accuse Sarah Lovell of being meek, but for her to imply, as she had, that she was acting without Henry's approval, or perhaps even his knowledge, came as something of a shock. Having gnawed on it for a while, Betsy reckoned it an aberration. There was no way she would defy her nephew. The thought evaporated as she spied Upton leading another horse, this time a big bay stallion.
"Mr. Upton, do we have another sick animal?"
"No, Mum," came with a meaningful look. "This one's fully fit, being taken down for stud duty. Just thought I'd come this path, then make my way round to the north gate for a bit of a change. I hope you don't mind."
"If you're going that way, it would please me to accompany you. I, too, could use a change of scenery."
As they began to walk, their heads either side of the equine head, Upton posed a question. It was pronounced in a manner that told Betsy he'd worked himself up to it. So strangled was his voice.
"If I was to say the servants are all in a lather about what's been going on, would you mind it?"
"The servants?"
Betsy asked cautiously.
"Not all, I admit," Upton gabbled, "but to include them who's been here a long time, those who knew you as a—"
The inability to finish prompted a rare smile from Betsy as well as a question.
"Knew me as something of a handful?"
"Never that, miss. Sorry, ma'am. We can't help feeling you's troubled. Not that we can do much about it, easy matters like."
What to say?
It sounded too outlandish in her head, never mind spoken out loud. The stuff of silly romances in which a hero rescues a damsel in distress from an evil baron. She didn't want to explain in detail, it was too diminishing. But nor, if the head groom was to be relied upon, could she let such an opportunity pass.
"All I will say, Mr. Upton, is that I am denied the liberty to depart Cottington Court as and when I please."
"And that you would wish for?"
The stallion was slightly startled by a pair of pigeons noisily exiting a full-leaf tree, which had it throw its head in the air with Upton pulling hard on the bridle. His face was briefly visible, and on it she observed a look of genuine concern, one which decided Betsy to take the plunge.
"What I require is the liberty to leave this house and grounds and never return, on foot if I must, but—"
He had to know what she was suggesting. Not only that he let her out through the north gate, but that he provide a horse as well. The stallion's head had been lowered again, so it was impossible to read Upton's expression as he replied.
"To be thought on, Mrs.—"
"Langridge, Mr. Upton. And if you hear me referred to by any other name, give it no credence. On this occasion, I think I have walked with you far enough. Perhaps another day."
"I recall you used to be fond of dropping into the stables from time to time. Might be a notion you should go back to doing that."
"Walked and talked, Mr. Creevy,"
the young lad said, he having been sent to follow Upton at a distance. 10 years old, he was sprightly, freckled, and missing his front teeth. Bonded to Cottington to learn the gardening trade.
"Each side of the horse, too."
"You weren't spotted?"
That got a furious shake of the head.
"Take a sharp eye to catch me."
"Well, keep it to yourself. A loose word'll see you out the gate with a bruised arse."
"Wouldn't say the story, Grady," Upton intoned, his face sad. "Seemed to me like she was shamed by it." since you've no idea of what happened, how could you know that?
A feeling. Might be she'll open up if we talk a few more times. I think she trusts me.
Grady started to wheeze, looking to deliver humorous riposte on being trusted. But Upton cut off his sally. Stow it!
It's you who might be stowing it if Tulkington finds out. I told you to have a care.
I ain't daft, Grady, and that's another one that don't need your humour. I will not walk as often as I've been doing of late, in case summat's suspected. You know what a nose the master has.
Make a good travel hound, he would.
Best not give him out to sniff at, then.
You're the one doing that, friend.
Grady tapped his head.
I ain't as short on a shilling as you.
Have a care your Christian charity don't show.
Betsy, with no one to talk to, was thinking on the same subject, alternating between the fear of a trap, then castigating herself for thinking that of a man who had always been kind to her. Had he got the drift? If she was to get away, he would have to unlock the gate and let her out on a horse, which would require a saddle. A reasonably competent rider, Betsy had no notion to go bareback over ploughed fields and pasture, with fences and hedges to jump if there was a pursuit. There were side saddles in the stables, but how could one be taken to where it needed to be without exciting comment? Sarah Lovell didn't ride, and was in any case in terror of horses, so that left only her. Walking a horse was one thing. Doing so with one saddled up would look bizarre. The first thing to do was visit the stables, as invited, to see how the land lay, and how long, in terms of time, she might have to wait. The knock at the door interrupted her thoughts, and she went to open it to find her aunt there.
A note came back from Annabel. I hope you do not object to my reading it.
Betsy was suddenly full of fear. What would Annabel say if she thought she was replying to her? Might she mention the note to Edward? Her heart was in her mouth until Sarah Lovell said,
"She is happy to receive us at 3 o'clock.
The brow furrowed.
Odd. She refers to the fact of my coming, too. That you never mentioned.
Nor will I mention, Betsy thought, that you read my note to Annabel without asking, so the reply was larded with sarcasm.
I dare say she knows I never go anywhere without first begging you to accompany me.
That was taken badly.
Have a care, Elizabeth. Do not tempt me to replicate your brother's ways of behaving.
Chapter 21. Having checked his goods were as near as they should be to what was expected, and a note made of discrepancies, Henry Tulkington could make his way back to Deal and the lodge in which he was a master mason. It was here that the important people and decision-makers of the town and surroundings gathered to celebrate their craft. Magistrates, men of business, the owners of large farms or sailing ships, plus the numerous chandlers who supplied them. The vicars and deacons of the local churches were attendees, also those of the Brotherhood merely passing through at temporary anchor in the Downs. Likewise, many of the naval and marine officers stationed in Deal at any one time would attach themselves as affiliated members. So would the Trinity House pilots, who saw ships down the Thames and back up again. It was in these rooms that various appointments were made. Who should hold the various plums in the gift of the Deal community, such as a harbour master for a place lacking a harbour? The duty involved seeing to the orderly berthing of ships and to extract the fees due for the right to anchor, a portion of the revenue retained by the office holder. The beach within the boundaries of Deal was no free-for-all either. If you wished to haul up a lugger, hoy or fishing boat onto the shingle, you had to pay a fee to the beach controller. He, not wanting to spend his life chasing his dues, tended to let them out in blocks for others to exploit. Likewise, he would issue a license to the wherries, small boats which transported passengers to and from their ships. That the Brotherhood looked after each other's interests was a given, but there would be no shame shown for that being so. It was seen as the natural order of things. The world required to be ruled by people of substance, with a stake in the maintenance of the law of the land. Mayhem would ensue if the lower orders were granted any powers. To those who might complain of their vice-like grip on local affairs, they would counter with their record on charitable giving. Money was raised by lodge members for the care of foundlings, as well as women widowed by the loss of their man between the shore and the Goodwins, a not uncommon occurrence. It was within these walls the collection had been made which part compensated the beach community for the loss of their boats due to Billy Pitt's arson. Henry'd been inducted as a young man, and was now a person of real standing, easily a match for his father. Likewise, his uncle Durley was a brother who had risen high in the Grand Lodge, where he mixed with the male offspring of King George, as well as a very large number of members of the House of Peers. It was said as many decisions of importance were made there as in Westminster. In the Deal Lodge, Henry would meet with those who could, if they chose, cause him difficulties. Not that such things were allowed to fester. As soon as any problem surfaced, it would be smoothed over, either by support for a cherished place or project, a gift of some very superior contraband, and in one or two cases, a downright bribe. It was also the case that no brother was required to pay John Hawker anything other than their taxes.
"Admiral Braddock, I find you in good spirits, I hope."
Henry was sitting at a table with a coffee pot, and seeing Braddock making to join him, he signalled for another cup.
"Tolerable, Tulkington, tolerable. Missed you at my soiree yesterday.
I was sadly away on business."
"I take it Mr. Pitt attended an event in his honour."
"He did," came with a glum expression, as the Admiral watched his coffee being poured.
"Can I assume from your look he gave you the usual lecture?"
"Nail on the head, Tulkington. Why am I not out catching smugglers, the booby? He's had it from me, as well as my predecessor, that it's not a task for the Navy. I'm damned if I know why he still bothers asking. If he wants us to chase contraband, he must get a bill to do it through Parliament, as well as a vote for the funds for an expanded role."
"Ah, Parliament, of which he's supposedly the master."
The ruddy sailor's face took on a sly look.
"But he ain't, is he? Much as he would have it otherwise."
Henry Tulkington wanted to gainsay the sentiment, for if governance was a bear pit in which action was ever stymied, Pitt had fared better than most, after the near-ruinous expenditure brought on by Lord North's handling of the American War. The public debt was down, and still falling, even if he'd bought in several sinecures, posts drawing an income for no work, which he saw as inimical to the public good.
"Elizabeth Carter was there," Braddock added, "the eternal spinster. Too clever by half, that woman."
"I didn't know she was back from town,"
was said with more interest than was truly felt, which allowed him to ask another question.
"What about that captain who's taken Quebec House? Name escapes me."
"Brazier,
that's the fellow.
It's being said he's a friend of Pitt."
"Not if what I saw of them is true. Observed them talking. And I'd say there was little love lost. Brazier looked as if he was giving Pitt a piece of his mind."
"Strange cove, nevertheless, wouldn't you say?"
That got a chortle. "If you'd ever been in the Navy, Tulkington, you'd scarce say that. We have some ripe specimens in our cabins. But Brazier has got some baggage."
"Really? More coffee?" Braddock was very eager to tell Henry that which he already knew about Brazier's relations with Prince William, albeit he was short on details of what had brought on the court-martial.
"Found for the Premier, and went on to reprimand Sailor Bill, who is, by all accounts, a fellow with a foul temper." A royal prerogative. Not one he'd exercise if he was under my command. Braddock huffed. That was taken with a large pinch of salt. Tulkington might know little of the Navy, but he knew a lot about men like Braddock, for whom ambition topped all other considerations. This would make him putty in Prince William's hands as he grovelled for royal favour. If he detested Brazier, it did no harm to note he was not of that ilk. "He's got another bit of bother on his plate," came with the smug air of a fellow knowing he possessed inside knowledge. The querying look from Tulkington had the Admiral shuffle his backside forward on the chair so he was closer, which allowed him to drop his voice. "Some malarkey in the West Indies, it's rumoured. His commanding officer pegged out in questionable circumstances, I'm told."
"Pegged out?"
"Found the Deep Six, or was dispatched there in short order. Next thing you know, Brazier's swimming in gold."
"Are you saying the two are connected?"
Braddock threw himself back into the chair, this time with an enigmatic and superior smile.
"Depends if you believe in coincidence."
The man Henry had come to meet appeared over Braddock's shoulder. He waved to indicate recognition and that he would be with him shortly, while Henry was wondering how he could probe further without revealing how well he knew of Brazier and his past.
"It's all rumour, mind, Tulkington, nothing definite.
Still, an interesting tale. Is what is implied being investigated?"
"Not as far as I know."
The face closed up and Braddock looked angry.
"But then, what the devil do I know, stuck in this godforsaken—"
He stopped himself from cursing Deal as his personal backwater, sitting where he was and with whom. What he said next was to cover for a degree of embarrassment.
"I'll let you know if I hear any more."
"Please do, Admiral Braddock," Henry said, standing up.
"One thing, what was this flag officer's name?"
"Hassel. Never liked the fellow myself. Too much given to showing off."
"If you'll forgive me, I've arranged to meet someone."
That someone was a fellow master mason called Tobias Sowerby. He owned and ran a comprehensive business transporting goods around the locality by horse-drawn vans. Further afield, it was by barge. People moving between Deal, Sandwich, and the surrounding parishes needed his services to carry their chattels, while the local tradesfolk, not willing to bear the expense of their own conveyances, plus a carter and possibly two, often hired Sowerby to move sale goods. There was a bit of a frisson to this meeting. Henry, having lost, he later established, a cartload of tea to Dan Spafford, sought to mitigate the damage by billing Sowerby and demanding recompense. He reasoned it was from his man the stuff had been stolen. The demand had been refused, with the arch observation that if Henry Tulkington wanted goods distributed, he might have to do it himself unless he wished to insure them.
"I hope you're not still smarting from our last encounter, Tobias."
"Why would I?"
"Was an obvious lie. The matter was settled."
Henry smiled and laid an affectionate hand on Sowerby's shoulder.
"And if I admit I was in the wrong," that caused a deep intake of breath. Henry Tulkington was not a man much given to apology. "I was in a bit of a passion, as you would be to see your possessions filched. I spoke in haste, and I now regret it."
Sowerby had his own problem. This man was his best customer by a county mile. While it mattered not to him the nature of the goods he was being asked to carry, indeed, it allowed him to charge a premium, the basis of the demand for recompense, one which had permitted him to undercut his rivals on normal commerce and drive several out of business.
"I came today with an offer to meet you halfway, Henry."
"Why, that's noble, Tobias."
"So the matter is now settled?"
"It was settled in my mind before I ever got home. But I will recall your kindness should I ever be tempted to let my temper get the better of me again."
Henry,
all bonhomie, handed over the details of what required to be delivered within horse carriage distance. Some to private addresses, mostly to various coaching inns, where those doing the buying would bring their carriages to meet the Sowerby vans. In addition came Durley's list of what was required to be dispatched by barge, a regular run to a warehouse at Chelsea Harbour. If he was smiling and calm, it was all outward show. Behind that facade, he was seething. Sowerby meeting him halfway did not fit the bill. He should have coughed up the lot. Henry was as aware as the man himself how he used the profits from moving contraband to grow his enterprise. The swine should have been grateful to him for his prosperity and taken a chance to show it in silver. One day Sowerby would end up like the others, bleeding and battered, dumped in a muddy ditch, getting what he deserved from John Hawker. How he wished it could be him handing out the deserved retribution. And he conjured up the scene in his head, the confrontation, the denials, the blows delivered, the pleas for mercy, utterly ignored, as a hard boot finished Sowerby off. It could not be, as he had to hold back from that. His responsibilities prevented Henry from proving to those who crossed him the price they would pay for their stupidity. But he truly wished to be the deliverer of punishment. It was a point often made to Hawker, if few other people, a notion the man scoffed at. For all his power, Hawker knew Tulkington was a weed who would as like faint at the sight of blood. As he rode home, Henry's temper seemed to increase, until he was loudly denouncing various souls, going all the way back to his childhood. Those who'd taken advantage of his inability to grow. At aged 13, he'd still looked like a child. The same people then guide him for gaining inches by the week until he towered over people he'd previously been obliged to look up at. If he gained height, it had not been matched by bulk, which left him still the victim. No one humbugged at Tulkington, not his fellow pupils at school, the likes of Roger Colpoys or his sister and her friends, with their insults they thought to disguise as witty sallies, which was doubly frustrating, for he could not touch them. There were others who'd been shown the error of their opposition. Sowerby surely deserved to be next. But not yet, he was needed. Henry, as he passed through Upper Deal, had calmed somewhat, moving on to turn over in his mind not only Sowerby getting his just deserts, but how he might be financially ruined as well. It was a sad conclusion, by the time he reached his gate, that he needed the man too much to do that which he wished. He would have to stick with him. The only other option was to take over the organization of transport himself, which flew in the face of how Durley and his father had arranged his inheritance. But he must find a way to send him a message and remind him who held the whip hand. He could recall, although he was not far beyond being breached, a time when Sowerby was no more than one man driving a dilapidated cart with a patched canopy and drawn by a near-knackered horse, too old for the plough. He had risen from near beggary to the ability to more than hold his head up in the lodge, but his elevation had come from the Tulkingtons, on certain conditions. All transport charges were settled in cash. John Hawker advised not to look too closely when tax gathering, part of the arrangement being that he kept no records of their transactions. Therein lay the purpose of the premium payment, to shield the name of Tulkington from his activities. Edward Brazier knew he was engaged upon something that had more hope attached to it than any possible chance of a positive outcome. Joe had gone through his possessions to dig out from under a mass of other objects, his telescope. This, from a vantage point of a dipping incline some 500 yards distant, was now trained on the Colpoys' house,
while his protection was dotted around behind him to make sure he was not disturbed. The building was typical of the area, four square and red brick, quartered with regulation windows of large sashes and small panes, added to enough chimneys to rate it substantial. It was set in a dip and well away from the barns, with haystacks in between. There was a water tower on the highest nearby point, speaking of no need for the courtyard well, which alone denoted prosperity. No formal gardens fronted Home Farm as at Cottington Court. It was a beech shingle driveway with chickens darting around, pecking for food. Having been there for some time, he'd seen a trio of carrot-topped children trailed by excited dogs go about their morning tasks, collecting eggs from the hutches into which the fowl retreated at nightfall, turning over the filth of the pigsty and taking indoors a milk churn brought to the house from the cowshed. In both build and such duties, it reminded Brazier of his own childhood home in Hampshire, bringing to mind the smell of freshly baked bread. That always managed to give his maternal grandfather indigestion, which had him drink near-boiling water to relieve it. His father was often away at sea, but when he was home, Brazier felt complete. As a ship's surgeon, he dealt with the common ailments of tars, and was circumspect in description, so it had been a few years of ignorance for son Edward before he witnessed, at too close a hand, what those ailments were. Sailors were permanently costive from too restricted a diet, which required extraction by a long probing spoon dipped in oil. Delirium tremens brought on by an excess of harboured rum rations too swiftly consumed, or a long period of drunkenness ashore, and that usually meant the pox as well, which brought out mercury and the terrifying probe. Worst of all were the results of a severe flogging for some heinous crime, a mincemeat back, added to the luminosity of battered flesh running with blood, fresh enough to glint in the morning light. When Roger Colpoys emerged, it was obvious he was the master of Home Farm. It lay in the overbearing way he waved his riding crop, added to the adopted spread-feet stance of impatience, when whatever unheard instructions he issued took too long to be obeyed. Brazier could see but not hear him, shouting at his children, and that pleased him, though he had no idea why. They did their best to ignore their irate sire even when he was remonstrating them from the elevation of the mounting block. Eventually he had his horse brought out, got astride it, and with the gate opened in readiness, rode off at a fast canter. And then there was nothing. Home Farm fell, as it would, into its daily routine. Servants going about their duties, piles of stinking hay being forked out of the stables onto carts, to join the collected dung being taken to the fields as fertilizer. The arrival of a dog cart set his blood running, until it disgorged an elderly, stooped cove, carrying books. If Dutchy, Peddler, and Cocky could not see as clearly as their captain, it took no great wit to comprehend little of interest was going on. And time was flying by. Peddler was moaning about being hungry, for the sun had peaked, which got a scoff from his mates for his rumbling gut.
"Happen they'll hear that belly rumbling down the oost, Dutchy. What you reckon?"
"They will if you fart, you Scots git," the victim of this jibe growled. "Fool's errand, this one," Peddler insisted.
"By my reckoning, the Turk can't go near the place."
"What tell you that?"
asked Cocky.
"If he could, we would have knocked at the door right off, as sweet as kiss my hand, to be shown into a farmhouse breakfast."
"Some folk," Cocky cawed, "the sensible ones, dream about women. With you it's eggs and smoked ham."
"Lasts longer as pleasure, Cocky, old mate. Fill a sack instead of draining it."
"Coach coming, lads." Dutchy's warning had all three sink into the tall meadow grass, left with the sound of clopping hooves as a berlin approached the gate of Home Farm. That opened by a lad rushing to the duty. Even at a distance, once the step had been lowered, the trio could see two women alight.
Only Edward Brazier, using his telescope, could put names to the figures. He felt a near physical pain to see Betsy, replaced by a flash of anger as he identified the inevitable aunt. A swift shift showed Annabel Colpoys in the doorway, a gesture of welcome very obvious. Words were being exchanged, and he could not hear them. Would the Colpoys woman convey back to Betsy his determination to rescue her? If not, what could he do? Brazier needed no secret gate to gain access to Cottington Court. A man who could climb 100 feet of rigging in a howling gale would not be troubled by a mere brick wall.